It's like I'm missing an attorney.
There is no attorney for the respondent.
Oh, thank you. My apologies. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals this afternoon, and we are next hearing the case of Sharon, is it McCree?
I think it's McCray, but I wasn't the counsel at district court, so I'm not, and she hasn't appeared here at all, so I'm not 100% sure.
All right, and you are representing Mr. Eric Smith?
Correct.
And your name for the record then?
Lisa Lodine Peralta.
All right, and Ms. Peralta, you will have 15 minutes for your argument before the court this afternoon. I'd ask you to be mindful of a couple of things since we're doing this on the WebEx format rather than at the courthouse. If the judges have questions, they'll raise their hand to indicate those, if you could keep an eye out for that. Also, the marshal will hold up a display of the time remaining in your argument on his cellular device, so you'll have some idea how much time you have remaining. And with that, you may start your argument. Thank you.
May it please the court. As indicated, I represent the appellant Eric Smith. He was the respondent below in this HRO matter. So this case is about a flawed order, which was based on three findings. And you should conclude that any or all of these flawed findings were fatal to the order, and you should reverse. So what's key is to understand which part of the harassment order we're controlled by in this case. So there's only one part that's at issue based on the judge's order, and that's 609.748 subdivision 1A and then subpart 1. This is probably referred to as the repeated incidents prong or part of the harassment definition. So under this repeated incidents part, there are two requirements. First, there must be repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures. That's the first requirement. Second, there must be a substantial adverse effect on the petitioner's safety, security, or privacy. We have argued there are problems with both prongs. So I'll go first to flaw number one. This is in relation to the finding of fact number two. There was a part of this judge's order that very specifically relied upon the fact that Mr. Smith had no right to reside in the residence owned by Ms. McCray.
Now, so Ms. Peralta, this is Judge Riley. I'm glad that you're starting out with that argument because I want to understand what the evidence is that there's a lease.
So
what can you point me to?
I'm sorry, what was the last part you said?
What can you point us to?
Sure. So the evidence in there is that Mr. Smith had moved in, I believe it was 2017, and he was paying $300 a month of rent. And so under Minnesota law, this would qualify as a month-to-month periodic at-will tenancy under an oral lease. There is no requirement under this sort of situation that it be a written lease. And so there was no dispute, and the evidence was clear that he was living there pursuant to this payment of rent. And so that would be the evidence in the record that would support the oral month-to-month lease. So with an oral month-to-month lease, Mr. Smith was entitled to proper notice before he would have had to remove himself or leave. Before, in other words, that the landlord had terminated the lease properly. And there is no evidence in the record to suggest at all that there was a proper notice in writing is what the statute requires. In fact, there was no lease apparently because Ms. McCray didn't want one because it might impact her welfare benefits. Yes, Judge Siegel.
Yeah, so if I've got an adult child living with me, and the adult child is helping contribute to expenses and does that on a monthly basis, then in order to remove that child from my house, you're saying I need to go file an eviction notice? I mean, when does it become a month-to-month tenancy at will? And when is it having a relative stay with you that at some point you say, get out of my house?
Okay, well, first of all, you wouldn't have to go to eviction right away anyway. The law would require, as we argue, a proper written notice, which is just required to be provided more than 1 month before the lease is to be terminated. And now whether there is in fact a lease would be determined by the evidence. And I'm not sure in your hypothetical what the evidence would be. I don't think there's any problem with there being an actual lease with an adult child. It would depend on what the facts and circumstances around it would be. So we would argue that there definitely could be an oral lease with a family member. It would just depend on the facts.
Ms. Peralta, so are you saying that there was an express contract lease or an implied lease?
I would suggest, I guess, quite frankly, I don't know the answer to that. I don't practice housing law, but when we look to the requirements for someone who is a tenant, and he was a tenant there, they're entitled to notice before an oral lease. And there was no contrary evidence that there wasn't an oral lease. So I don't think without a challenge to the fact that he was a tenant, that there needs to be a determination on implied or explicit. Yes, Judge Larkin.
I'm confused. I don't understand how you can argue that your client was entitled to notice of termination of a tenancy at will without first establishing that there was, in fact, a tenancy at will, which I think would require you to answer the question of whether it was created explicitly or implicitly. Am I misunderstanding?
So you may not be misunderstanding, but you have to recognize that this determination by the court came out of nowhere. The parties did not litigate this fact. Mr. Smith was the respondent. So it was the petitioner's obligation to establish the basis for this order. And so to the extent that the court found as a finding of fact in the order that he did not have a right to reside there, the burden of proof was on the petitioner to establish he did not have a right to reside there. Yes, Judge.
So why is this not a credibility finding by the judge on what the facts were about his living at Ms. McCrae's residence? I mean, it seems like there was testimony back and forth at the hearing. You know, he showed up. No, she knew I was coming. He just showed up with his kids. I let him in. I kept asking him to leave. He wouldn't. I mean, that doesn't sound like a tenancy at will to me, if you believe Ms. McCrae. And then, you know, even Mr. Smith acknowledged that, yeah, she kept asking me to leave. I mean, or it was more than once or something. I don't want to exaggerate the record. So how do we deal with this now on appeal if the judge in fact found, I believe, Ms. Craig? I mean, they just showed up. There's no tenancy here.
So there's two problems with the facts as referenced by you. Number one, Mr. McCrae and his children lived there from December 17th until this happened in January, February of 2019. So this establishes a tenancy at will because he's been living there with his children for that long. Yes, Judge Larkin, I did have one more finding of fact that I want to get to after your question.
Absolutely. Thank you. I wonder, even if the district court erroneously found that your client did not have a right to reside there, why it matters. We have people who are ordered from their homes pursuant to harassment restraining orders and orders for protection all the time. In other words, it's no defense to an order for protection, or I guess I should say harassment restraining order that restrains somebody from being at a certain location to say, but I have a legal right to be there. So I'm wondering why this matters. Even if he did have a written lease, if the district court properly found that he was harassing his landlord, doesn't the law allow the district court to issue a harassment restraining order that prevents him from being at the apartment?
Your Honor, I believe that you cannot separate in this instance the judge's finding of fact. In this instance, the judge did not check mark any of the boxes on the standard order. The judge wrote, I find that there's reasonable grounds to believe harassment based on other. And it was one sentence, and as part of that sentence indicating he refused requests to leave when he had no right to be there. So it was an integral finding of fact to the judge's determination. And so, but let me go on that even if the district court did not err in this finding of fact as to whether he had a right to reside there, and I would call that a mixed question of law and fact, there are two other fatal flaws here. And that would be that he actually refused and that there were repeated requests. I think the court clearly erred onto the repeated incidents. And this gets to your question, Judge Siegel. There were, if you look closely at the testimony, which is kind of all over the place because the petitioner was seemingly confused and not able to keep her timeline straight. This third time is what's important because it's the third time he lives there from December 17th to 2019. And you have to focus on how many times did she request that he leave there? And there is only evidence to suggest at least valid evidence that is sufficient to support the finding that there was one request made. Then if you go to the part of the finding of fact that he refused, even Ms. McCrae's own testimony does not support a finding of fact that he refused to move out at that time when she asked him. So he admits he got asked once. He and she both say he agreed essentially to move out, and he went and he looked for a place to stay. He found a place to stay. It just was going to take a couple weeks. So when Ms. McCrae was specifically asked, did he refuse to leave? Her answer to the question was no. He said he was going to move out in a couple of weeks when he got his new apartment. So these two findings of fact, regardless of the right to reside there, do not establish sufficient evidence for the repeated incidents definition or the requirements for that. There's a third fatal flaw here, and that fatal flaw goes to paragraph 3 of the order, which is checkmarked for there was a substantial effect on the petitioner's safety, security, and privacy. So under this requirement, there are also two prongs. There must be unreasonable conduct and intent by the respondent, Mr. Smith, and there must be an objective, reasonable belief of this substantial adverse effect. We contend there's actually not sufficient evidence to support this ruling on either of these prongs. So the unreasonable conduct and intent is not just an objective test, it's a...
So Ms. Peralta, Judge Riley, so when I read that, it's an or, not an and. The harassment has or is intended to have. So it's either or. You don't need the intent on your client's part, as I read the statute.
Even if that's the case, that we're not going to evaluate it under intent, it has to be unreasonable conduct. And that interferes with substantial or with safety, security, and privacy. And when the facts here are that the one time the evidence shows that she asked him to leave and he didn't say no, and went out and looked for an apartment, he found an apartment, he put down a security deposit for the apartment, and he planned on leaving. So the objective evidence that Ms. McCray would have had a substantial effect on her safety, security, and privacy for him to refuse to move out, it doesn't meet it. It's not supported by the evidence to be an objective conclusion of that. And I kind of can't really see the timing, but I assume that I'm up.
All right. Are there any other questions from the panel members? All right. Thank you. Your time is up. We appreciate your argument this afternoon. The case is submitted, and you'll have our decision within the time required by statute.
Thank you.
That concludes the court's oral hearings.